Welcome to The Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside Baseball Prospectus' local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes by searching for The Catbird Speaks. You can go there, rate us, review us. I'm Colin Whitchurch, joined as always by Nick Schaefer. What's up, Nick?
Hey, Colin. How's it going?
Good. We have a special episode today. The White Sox top 10 prospect list is up on baseballprospectus.com. You can go there and find it. And on the call with us today, we have one of the authors of that list from Baseball Prospectus' prospect team, Jarrett Seidler. How's it going, Jarrett?
Pretty good.
Good.
Just going through a lot of prospect lists and a lot of book writing right
now. I can imagine. So we can go through some of the specifics of the White Sox top 10 and what your guys' mindset was in certain rankings, but I guess to start off, I just kind of wanted to get your overall feel of the White Sox system. Obviously, there's been so much changing over the last year. They brought in a whole bunch of talent. They've already graduated some of that talent. So I guess, you know, what are your general feelings for the state of the system right now?
Yeah, so basically, the White Sox system graduated what was probably at the time that he got called up the top prospect in baseball, Yan Moncada, and is still a pretty clear top five system. So it's very good. They did a very good job of talent accumulation in the various trades that they've made. They had some incumbent talent. They've done a pretty good job taking shots on certain guys, Alec Hansen specifically, in the draft. And they went out and signed Luis Robert, who was, if nothing else, the last Cuban that you could use your huge financial advantages to sign under age 25.
Yeah, I mean, alongside, it's exciting to hear that it's still that strong because, you know, they, like you said, they graduated Moncada and they also graduated Giolito and Lopez, who were on the midseason top 50.
Sure.
So it's encouraging that they could still, you know, have those guys not eligible and it's still being consideration at or near the top spot. I guess it makes the most sense to start at the top. I mean, maybe that's like the easiest because it's not as, I feel like 1-2, maybe not the sequencing of 1-2 was easy, but I feel like the 1-2 kind of jump out. I don't know where you come down on the Jimenez versus Kopech rankings, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
So I think there's like two things at work here that, cause, and I don't want to trash Scott Delp too much, or actually argue the other side of this and like our contrary opinion. But I think there's starting to become some prospect fatigue on Eloy Jimenez just because he keeps just doing Eloy Jimenez things and he's kind of steady in the rankings. You know, we ranked him 9th overall last year. I think he's going to move up a few spots on the 101, but not that many. In part because he's a corner guy and it's hard for a corner guy to, without doing like amazingly spectacular things, move up on the list. But he did put up like a 950 OPS across high A and double A this past year, which is good. And the scouting reports on him basically remained the same. You have a few people that are like dissenters and think he's going to end up at first base instead of one of the corner outfield spots. I'm not really one of them. I still think with Kopech, there's a lot of reliever risk there. And I know White Sox fans are not going to want to hear that. There's a lot less than there was last year, but like last year it looked like most probably a reliever. And now maybe it's like, you know, maybe a starter and maybe a reliever. So even though he made a pretty significant jump in like the starter probability, it's still not 100%. You're still talking about a guy with a huge command and control problem, a guy that has, you know, kind of nagging injuries, a guy whose best stuff is probably going to play up in short stints. You know, you tend to hear like the 102, 103 mile an hour reports, like in shorter stints in situations where, let's just say he's not working week to week there as a starter. Like week to week as a starter, he's working like 97 to 100, which is good, but it's not 102 or 103. And at 97 to 100 with a really good slider, can that be a good starter? Yeah, sure, absolutely. But I think there needs some work on the third pitch. It's like every like every starting pitching prospect has like the same concerns, except for a couple of them. Needs work on changeup, needs additional durability, potential injury risk.
Command problems.
Yeah, command problems. So it's not like, I don't want to say this is unusual, and you know, what is unusual is we're ranking him as among, you know, the 5-6 best pitching prospects in baseball. I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out. He's going to be somewhere up there. And he's like the only guy among that group that actually has that risk. Most of the guys, he like has the risk profile of like a guy that's like maybe the 50th or 60th best prospect in baseball. And we're giving him a lot of extra credit for the quality of the stuff and the success at AA to get him into, you know, the top 20 or 25.
So is it fair to say that he's like the best possible version of those crazy, risky, not sure if you're a starter types? I mean, him and like,
Alex Reyes is, but
is, I mean, other than the TJ, was how much risk was there for Reyes to stay in the rotation?
There was some, just because kind of a similar mechanical questions. He tended to hold his velocity, the higher ranges of his velocity better. And his third and his changeup had developed by the time he made the majors. By the end of the 2016 season, I don't think there was a ton of risk. But like at the beginning of the 2016 season, there certainly was. Like at the same point in their developmental pattern, I think there was similar risk. But Reyes grew a lot over the course of 2016, which led us to make him the top prospect in baseball, and they blew his elbow a day later. literally a day after that list was published.
It was one day? Oh, yep. God. With Kopech, I mean, a guy like that, obviously the upside ceiling, whatever you want to call it, seems very high. How much stock do you put into something like, you know, the reports that I heard, which were probably fewer than the ones you did, were that about mid-season where it looked like Kopech was starting to flag, it was framed to me that he made a conscious choice to take a little off his fastball, and I heard that he was a little bit better on line to the plate, and then all of a sudden he went on this huge run where he was pitching later into games and not walking guys nearly where he was at before. I mean, is that the type of thing where you just say, you know, we'll see if he can keep that up, or do you think that that's a really encouraging thing that he could do that, or is it just noise?
It cuts both ways, because in doing that, the quality, you know, the reports that we were getting on him at the end of the season, just in terms of pure stuff, weren't as good because he was taking a little bit off of the fastball, and all of a sudden, you know, a lot of guys throw 96 to 98 now, like, and that really was up until, I would say, maybe late 2016, even maybe around the time of the trade, there was a lot of Red Sox helium on Michael Kopech, if you know what I mean.
I do.
You know, that really was his calling card. You know, the reports that he hit 105, which we've always been a little bit skeptical of. But we do have confirmed reports that he was hitting like 102, 103 with like somewhat decent regularity. But you look at it, and he was hitting 102, 103, and in 2016, he pitched a combined 56 innings. In 2015, he pitched a combined 65 innings. So, yeah. I mean,
some of that's not injury-related, though.
The reasons he did that are also huge red flags, too. He kept getting suspended for stuff.
Yeah, those are bad, too.
Yeah. Punch your teammate with not your pitching hand. Punch him with the other hand, you know? if you have no idea what we're talking about, he has a drug suspension. He has a suspension for getting into a fight with his teammate, which was then exacerbated by the fact that he broke his pitching hand in said fight.
I mean, that just makes me throw a Kevin Brown comp on him. Sorry.
Right. These are red flags. These are potential. And there had always been kind of vague makeup issues surrounding him that kind of, you know, those are probably the actualization of your vague makeup issues that we can't really talk about.
So it's kind of funny. Obviously, we talk about Kopech and, you know, his ceiling versus his risk. You know, the White Sox have a couple of those guys, I guess, every pitcher is that guy to a certain extent, every pitching prospect at least. Dylan Cease, another example. But I'm more curious about Alec Hansen because, I mean, and you even write about, you know, how inexplicable it's been, his rise from potential number one overall pick to having a terrible season at Oklahoma to now, you know, being every bit that prospect that people saw in him that made him a potential number one overall pick. Have you ever seen kind of a pitching prospect fluctuate that in that way, in the way Hansen has? And does that make it any more risky to you that he might revert back into kind of the struggles that saw him fall, you know, 2 years ago?
Oh, yeah, this happens all the time. But and sometimes it does fall back. Dellin Betances is a great example of this. You know, there were periods in Dellin Betances was probably a prospect of about this same hype, was a seven-figure high school, like, later-round guy. I think he got seven figures. He got a lot of money to buy about the Vanderbilt commitment, like the eighth round by the Yankees.
Yeah.
And at times he would be, like, looking like top pitching prospect. And then I saw it where he was, like, throwing, you know, like, eight consecutive balls to the backstop. And there was, like, no – and, like, he was in a spot that first year that he was an elite reliever, which I guess would be 2014. Does that sound right? I probably should have looked this up quickly.
I don't think anyone's going to kill you for it.
Yeah, 2014. He had to make the Yankees roster that spring. He was out of options and was a DFA candidate, like made it as like their last reliever. Ended up making the All-Star team and was third in Rookie of the Year voting.
He's part of that, what, like Betances, Brackman, Benuelos crew?
The Killer Bees, like... yes.
Yeah.
And I guess the second most successful of those was Brackman because he ended up playing pro basketball in Europe for a little while.
Does that even count?
I don't know, but Benuelos, like, was never an effective pitcher, like, even in the high minors, so...
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you, but we were talking.
This happens a lot. I'm working on a piece that may or may not ever see the light of day. Like, Roy Halladay was a guy that this happened to.
Oh, wow.
Where he was, like, a top pitching prospect. And this happened to him essentially in the upper minors and the majors. And they sent him all the way back down to the complex and extended spring training. He, like, pitched an A-ball for a while, saw a sports psychologist, and then came back and had Roy Halladay's career.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of it becomes, you know, some of the question is, at, you know, just at what point does it occur? And I guess for Hansen, in Hansen's case, it occurred right before the draft, which enabled the White Sox to grab him with their third pick in that draft. I think I think he was technically a second rounder.
He was top of the second rounder. He got like,
yeah,
he was like 49th overall or something.
Yeah, and he may wind up being the best. I mean, certainly in the White Sox class from that draft. But you've seen him a few times. I remember you had a write-up where you saw him against Sixto Sanchez, which, you know, yeah, that's makes him look a little less impressive, I'm sure, by comparison. But is it fair to say that you – what's the right phrase for this? Are you a Hansen believer, I guess?
Yes, I really like Alec Hansen. I see no reason other than the fact that he was inexplicably bad semi-recently. Other than that, like, if that didn't exist, you know, he would be right there with Kopech, I think. But it does exist, and it's not, you know, that really elevates the risk factor because Kopech, the risk factor is, you know, maybe he's Joe Kelly, the reliever. But still a pretty good major league player, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a good major league reliever. Hansen, for all I know, could, you know, lose his release point again and never make the majors. And that's a much more realistic downside factor with Hansen than it is Kopech. So when we talk elevated risk, you know, the risk is higher for Kopech than it is for, say, like Forrest Whitley or Brett Honeywell or maybe even Sixto Sanchez. I don't know. He's pitched better at higher level than Sixto, so that would actually be kind of an interesting one. But he also arguably doesn't have Sixto stuff. That would be an interesting debate, actually. Who has better stuff, Sixto Sanchez or Michael Kopech?
I mean, Sixto's got more like versions of fastball, right? Like,
right. Like, it's just like, and he's eventually probably going to pick three pitches, but I don't exactly know which three pitches it's going to be. I would probably prefer that over the guy that definitively has two pitches and needs to work on a third pitch. But there are people that would go the other way. In terms of fastball, they're pretty similar. I don't know. That might actually be a column idea. that's like a good like 101 time column idea. But yeah, Hanson, like I, you know, so like the issues with Hanson are he's huge, which adds some mechanical questions anyway, because, you know, again, you start looking at Dylan Betances was another guy with like this body frame, you know, like 6'7", 6'8", 260, 280 pounds. Like,
is Glasnow the other guy like that, or
yeah, there's a lot of guys like that. Like guys with huge frames just like tend to lose the release point just because it's much easier to lose your release point. And it's not just like height, it's like length of arm, and arm action too. And you know, Hanson's lost it before, so it's easier to imagine a circumstance under which he loses it again. But to get, like, you know, a guy that a year and a half out from the draft is already, you know, a top 50 prospect at number 50, wherever the hell they took him, 47, 50, wherever it was, that's like a hell of a find. And it's, you know, especially they didn't even allow him. I don't even think he was an overslot guy there.
Yeah, and it was gratifying too, because they, you know, as I was following it as it happened, and certainly not a draft expert, but they took Collins and then Zach Birdie, which felt kind of conservative. So it was nice to see them, you know, willing to take a higher risk, potential higher impact guy with the third pick. You know, in context, those three sort of felt nice together. Yeah. Certain, and obviously, you know, it helps that it looks like it's worked out pretty well. I don't want to get hung up too much at the very top, even though it is interesting. I feel like it's kind of clearer what the possible outcomes are when you get towards the top of the list. I mean, you mentioned just briefly, I don't want to skip over Eloy entirely because he's fun to talk about. There is the debate mostly centered around whether he's a corner outfielder or a first baseman.
Yeah, and it's also like the level to which he'll hit. Like, I think everybody agrees that he'll hit, but you have to like really hit. Like, is he going to be like a 320 hitter with power? Is he going to be like one of the best hitters in the majors, or is he just going to be like a 280 hitter with like, you know, 20 or 25 home runs? Which again is still a good player, but there's like some question about whether it's a good player or a perennial MVP candidate type player. Whereas you compare like Ronald Acuna, I think there's a much greater belief that this guy's probably going to be like a perennial MVP all-star type guy.
I mean, in terms of separating out, I guess it's the question too is, I think on the midseason list, Eloy was the highest ranked guy who didn't play a premium defensive position, or at least could play. I mean, cause I think a lot of the other guys were up the middle.
I believe that is true, except that he's been passed by Vlad Jr.
Oh, since the midseason.
Yeah.
So then is it a question like Acuna's bat versus Jimenez's bat? How much of that is that issue versus, you know, the fact that Acuna can probably play center?
I think I would still take Acuna's bat there.
Oh wow, okay.
But it's close. You know, if they both had similar defensive and speed profiles, it would be really close. It would be really big. It would be a good argument. Same with Victor Robles too. Although that's a little bit, Acuna is kind of a similar offensive profile to Eloy, I think, in terms of what kind of power we expect him to hit for, in terms of what kind of batting average, whereas Robles, I think we're expecting a lot more batting average. You know, if we were ranking the best bat in the minors, it would be Vlad Jr. So Vlad Jr. would be ahead of all of these guys, except that we're pretty darn convinced that he's going to be a first baseman. Maybe not a very good one.
And I think you mentioned that you're on the more optimistic side that Eloy could hang in a corner outfield spot.
Yeah, I don't see why he would have to move. I haven't seen a ton of him, so I'm willing to defer to people. But like the people that have seen a ton of him tend to be the people that don't think that that's a huge concern. like, he's a big guy, but he's pretty athletic, and I don't think he's going to end up being, like, real hefty. You know, it's a pretty good arm, too. So it's like, why would he have to move?
And for what it's worth in Chicago, I mean, it's a pretty small outfield. So, you know, that's a secondary concern, I guess. But I certainly cuts in that favor if you're not sure.
But, I mean, if you look at, like, the top, I don't know, I'm pulling up, like, our draft list. Like, the only, like, corner outfield first base bats that we don't think are going to bring anything else, like, you have to go really deep on the list before you get past, like, other than Vlad and Eloy and maybe Kyle Tucker. You know, maybe Kyle Tucker can play center. We're, like, down into the 50s until we have another of these guys, so... Yeah,
so he can hit. He can hit.
Yeah, like for us to be putting Eloy Jimenez consistently as a top 10 prospect, we really think he can hit because we tend to be, for various reasons, perhaps a little biased against corner bats.
Okay, so then after this top, I mean, it's interesting to you know, you've got the top two dudes, and then you've got Hanson, who we talked about, Ceasen Robert. They feel like these hyper extreme prospect types where it's like, if you want to dream on it, it's really fun, but who knows? I mean, what was it like trying to place these guys?
So there's like two different things here. Dylan sees to me just like breaks are like OFP likely thing, because like the OFP is really that he's an ace, and the likely is really that he's like in, like, I don't know, Brandon Morrow or somebody like that, where he's like injured all the time and sometimes really good and sometimes compromised by injury and probably reliever a lot of the time. And there's like a lot of those guys around. Brandon Morrow just comes to mind because of his recent success. And like, when I say Brandon Morrow, like, you understand the type of career I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Totally.
You know, this is a guy that can touch 100, works consistently in the mid-90s with a ton of movement, you know, has a potential, like, elite curveball, has an idea of what he's doing with his changeup. I can't tell you his arm is going to stay attached for any length of time, because it hasn't.
And, right.
You know... it's not the cleanest delivery in the world. A lot of people think he's just going to end up being a reliever. He's been handled with extreme care, both by the Cubs and the White Sox after he was acquired. You know, this is a guy that's a 2014 draft pick that just made an abbreviated full season debut. So he's been kicking around a while.
Do you see, you know... I feel like I've heard you mention this on For All You Kids Out There. It's the BP Mets podcast. It's Jarrett and Jeff Paternostro, who happen to be a massive proportion of our prospect team. I recommend listening to it regardless of your team affiliation.
Yes, it's also functionally our prospect and pro wrestling podcast.
Yes, I was going to say, for people who like pro wrestling, it's worth it for that, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, Colin's also a wrestling fan, so I totally spaced on the fact that, like, we could, if we had more time, maybe we could.
Oh, I plan on asking some wrestling questions at the end. Jarrett and I are actually a part of the same group DM about Japanese wrestling, so.
And you've got Wrestle Circuit down there, which is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, I do. I go every month. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Colin's Instagram is good for that. Oh, gosh, where was I going with that?
Don't see this.
Yes. So you've talked about how Andrew Miller's an example of this, and I guess Morrow to an extent, where you get these guys where it's like, man, if we could get this guy to work, or, you know, as a starter, we'll be golden, and teams beat their heads against the wall with it. And it takes a couple organizations before an org is willing to just be like, let's make this guy a reliever. And then all of a sudden, you know, they benefit handsomely from it. I think this is a concept you've talked about on your show. I mean, with Cease, this is his second organization now, although he wasn't dumped by any means. But I mean, do you think the White Sox just try their hardest to make this guy a frontline starter, and they've accumulated enough of them that they just do that? Or do you think there's a chance that they just, you know, pretty quickly say, we're going to try to get you know, 80 innings out of him in relief, maybe in 3 to 6 out stints, and just embrace the new normal with starter usage.
I think we're probably still a year or two away from them making that decision. Like, I don't think you need to make that decision while the guy's at high A, which is where I assume he's probably going to pitch most of next year, high A or double A. Probably actually both if he pitches well. It's going to depend on how much he can pitch, how tired he starts looking. Like, he was tired and gassed at the end of this season in which he did not pitch a tremendously large amount of innings. He got pulled from the Arizona Fall League. He was complaining of, like, general soreness. This is after 93 innings. So it's like, that's another red flag. He's a guy that, like, we really don't have a good handle on ranking. We have a much better handle on ranking him than Luis Robert. But, you know, I don't know. Like, ask me that question again if we do this next year, and I think there'll be a much clearer answer. I don't think the answer is clear on that. But, you know, he's already 21. You know, he's going to pitch most of the next season at 22. So, like Alec Hansen, he's actually not young for the levels he's pitching at, which is it's not nearly as big of a deal for a pitching prospect as it is for a hitting prospect, especially a pitching prospect with premium stuff. Like, if a guy's like 22 and tearing up a ball, throwing like 87 with a changeup, then the age is a problem. But if he's tearing up a ball with, like, you know, 97 and a hammer curve, less of a problem.
Yeah, Jack Egbert versus Dylan.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So. Yeah, I don't know. I'm guessing he's going to end up being a reliever. The White Sox tend to be really good at figuring this kind of stuff out. And I know with C specifically, you know, Rick Hahn, like, went into the mechanics of the Quintana trade at Sabre Seminar, and it was like, we're taking... Because, you know, if you look at the public rankings, C is kind of ranked similarly to, like, Adbert Alzolay, and, you know, maybe Oscar Del Cruz or Trevor Clifton. These are other pitchers in the Cubs system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Rick Hahn at Sabre Seminar was like, we're taking Cease. That's the deal. Like, there was not negotiation room on Cease versus Adbert Alzolay in the story that he told.
That's comforting. I mean, obviously, there's like, you know, after the fact, your decision, you know, you're kind of limited on what you could say, but still, that is encouraging, because I think a part of what you came away with, you were talking about Hahn's speech at Sabre, was that he seems to come from the school of negotiating where he's not trying to, like, mess with you, or he's just sort of like, listen, this is how we feel about it, and this is what's on the table, and that's kind of, it is what it is, sort of. Yeah. So
like, brief 2-minute digression on what the hell we're talking about. He had basically went through the Quintana negotiations, and he had, I guess, reached the point in which he had gotten an offer from an unnamed team who he would not name, but I think a lot of people guessed it was the Nationals. I don't know if that matches with, like, the rumors of the time period or not. But he would not name the other team, but he had gotten an offer from another team that was good enough to trade Quintana. And he went back to Theo Epstein and said, like, I'm trading Quintana. If you want him, it's got to be Cease and Jimenez. And, like, there's no room for discussion on that. And I guess because Rick Hahn has a certain reputation for honesty and forthrightness as general managers go, like, when he says that kind of thing, another general manager would believe him, whereas there are other executives.
Also, he happened to call Theo on the same day that John Lester was giving up, like, 8 earned runs and a third of an inning or something like
which
that.
Which he claimed was an accident.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea, but something that you glean from that is that they like Dylan Cease a hell of a lot more than they like the other Chicago pitching prospects, the Cubs pitching prospects. Which I think is valuable information, because I don't see any reason he would be bullshitting about that.
No, and like you said, I mean, if for all the difficulties the White Sox have had as an organization, as far as pitching evaluation and development, that's definitely been one of their strong suits. We've taken so much time, we haven't even gotten to the more divisive guys yet.
Oh, God. Luis Robert. I wrote the Luis Robert blurb. He's probably like either like 2 or 25 on this list. I don't think 5 is correct. I just have no idea where to put them. We have no information on Luis Robert.
I mean, it's not really any different from the midseason, right? When you guys just kind of put a little.
We didn't even rank midseason. Yeah. We didn't even rank him midseason. We just put at the bottom. Yeah, Luis Robert is probably somewhere on here. We just don't know where. But we like couldn't do that for the end of season list for various reasons.
For sure.
Here's the information we have on Luis Robert. He obliterated the Dominican Summer League. He shouldn't have been in the Dominican Summer League. He was only in the Dominican Summer League for tax reasons. He obliterated Serie Nacional like 2 years ago, which is the top-level Cuban league. That league is so weak at this point that it doesn't mean a whole lot other than it's good to be good there other than bad.
Right.
He had barely played for the top-level Cuban national team. He had mostly played in like second-level junior tournaments. There's some thought that they were hiding him because they knew it was a defection risk. The entirety of his stateside professional experience is like a dozen games in the Can-Am League with like a second-tier Cuban traveling squad in 2016, in which reports were very mixed, and a lot of the Cubans were like reportedly spending more time trying to defect than actually playing baseball. several of them, so one or two of them, if I recall correctly, was actually successful during that series. So the best evidence we have on Luis Robert is that the White Sox spent a lot of money on him, and they crippled their ability to make international signings for the next two signing periods, under which the rules were going to be a lot more, even. Yeah. So based on the amount of money we got and based on kind of like these vague reports we have, I think 5 is like the lowest we can reasonably rank him. Honestly, we're recording this a couple days before the list is out. If he ends up being 3 or 4, like, don't be shocked, because that's something that's still pretty fluid. We tend to rank guys for the most part based on our in-person evaluations and in-person evaluations of people we trust, you know, scouts we talk to, front office people we talk to, et cetera, et cetera. I cannot find anybody. I can find one person that saw Luis Robert in that Can-Am League series. I can't find one person that saw Luis Robert in the Dominican Summer League. Like, the foreign complex leagues are just like this giant black hole. Like, baseball goes on there, but nobody sees it. So I don't. We can't rank him based on the things we usually use to rank players.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Yeah,
Sorry, go ahead, Nick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, like, the stuff that we've heard since he signed are things that are, like, baseball adjacent. Like, the fact that his sprint times were higher than they had been the last time we've been clocked in game, such that his speed is, like, further up the chart. Maybe.
That's right. The first time in his life, he's undergoing a high-level nutrition and conditioning program.
Yeah.
That's not uncommon.
Yeah, I think...
That's the week, too.
I heard you mention, like, Ahmed Rosario, not the exact same scenario, but, like, he was somebody who responded really well to the Mets training program. And he went from, like, average to slightly plus runner to, like, top of the charts runner.
That's not uncommon for players around this age in other sports, specifically college football. So it's just been uncommon. It's becoming more common in baseball as some of those training methods have crossed over to baseball. Yeah, it's just kind of weird.
You may never have to make this call because of the timing, you know, the time scale that all these guys are on. Based on what little we know, at the optimistic end of things, is there a universe where, like, let's say this time next year, Robert is ahead of Eloy on the 25 and under?
Oh, yeah, he could be the top prospect in baseball at this time next year. I have no freaking idea.
Okay.
No, he absolutely could. You know, this is a guy that they spent, you know, a total of, like, I don't know, $53 million or whatever, like, what the penalties end up being. And, like, there are reports that are just, like, amazing on his athletic ability. And if it turns out he can hit, yeah, he could absolutely be the top prospect in baseball next year. He could also be totally – he could also turn out to not be able to hit and be off the 101 entirely.
Sure. Okay, so that's all in there.
Yeah. Like, there's, like, no – like, he could be – Yan Moncada, and he could be Rusty Castillo, and, like, those are very, those are not even, like, the extreme ends of the profile. Those are just, like, the 20 in the, you know, the 20th percentile and the 80th percentile. Those aren't even, like, the extreme ends.
Yeah, I mean, like, we're talking about, it just reminds me, like, going way back, you know, you had a guy, like, I'm thinking of Jeremy Reed, where Reed was a guy who was, like, a top five prospect, certainly in the BP list once upon a time. He was a centerpiece on a deal for Freddy Garcia. He was supposed to be this, like, can't-miss bat who might be able to hang in center field. And then he turned into, like, an all-glove center fielder for a little while who couldn't hit. And it's, like, that's a guy who I think was a college pick who had a lot of, like, stateside, you know, eyes on him. And he still turned out to be, like, massively different than we expected. And so this is like that times a thousand, I would think. But
yeah, I love writing about those kinds of prospects that are the exact opposite of what they were supposed to be. Trevor Plouffe is another really good one. He did like the opposite thing. He was supposed to be a glove first shortstop and then turned into an all bat third baseman, first baseman.
We always think about that with Tyler Flowers here, who it was.
Yes, Tyler Flowers.
Well, he's going to hit, but can he catch? And now he's a. Well, I guess he had a pretty good year hitting last year, but he became for a while, he's a pretty good defensive catcher who can't hit for his life.
I had a conversation with somebody about the Gold Glove Awards, and that person was dismayed that Tyler Flowers did not win the Gold Glove this year.
Yeah. I like that Floridian – I want to call him Tyler Glove.
Tyler Glove.
Tyler Glove.
So the back half seems like a lot more a lot less high-end stuff here. I mean, it makes sense, right? But, like, you don't – you know, you have Cease and Robert and even the guys above them are, like, you know, risky, but the upside is so, so high. And then you move past it and you get to the sort of Dunning, Berger, Rutherford
– boring prospects.
Collins types where, like, you don't – it isn't immediately apparent how these dudes are going to be, like, impact talents versus maybe major league regulars. Is that a fair distinction in the top half of this top 10 versus the bottom half?
I think, and this is going to drag a little into the next 10 too, I think that's a fair distinction on the hitting side. Okay. On the pitching side, I think they've got, you know, Carson Fulmer's not really that. Dane Dunning kind of is. But you, like, drop into, like, you know, Spencer Adams is a pretty high upside guy. Ian Clarkin, if he ever stays healthy, is a pretty high upside guy. AJ Puckett's a pretty high upside guy. Like, they've really, and this is actually something I wrote about in one of my articles. I think it was the Cease article.
I think
the White Sox have aggregated a ton of, like, risky pitching prospects, which greatly enhances the probability that some of them will turn out. Because they're not, like, these aren't, like, paired outcomes. These are totally unpaired outcomes. And, like, if you take a lot of guys that are, like, 30% chance to be, like, a good major league starter, well, if you have, like, 10 of them, then, like, on balance, you should get, like, 2 to 4 good major league starters, which is not that many fewer than you need. and they've kind of done – they've just, like, got a lot of these guys. Like, I would not individually bet on Dylan Cease or Michael Kopech becoming, like, a top-end major league starter. But if you have two of them, the odds are pretty good that one of them will be.
Or, like, Hanson as well, I guess.
Yeah, if you throw Hanson in, you know, if you put, like, Hanson, Cease, Kopech, and Dunning together, you got a pretty good chance to get, like, two top-end arms, maybe a relief arm, and one of them busts, you know? Something like that's probably, like, your median case. And that's really good. Like, that puts you in a really good position in a couple of years. But on the bat side, you know, I really like Jake Berger's ability. I don't think he's a third baseman. I haven't even talked to anybody that thinks he's a third baseman. Like, everybody just kind of agrees he's a first baseman. And that's actually kind of fine because there really isn't, like, great, you know. Jose Abreu, I assume, is moving to DH at some point, which would probably be around the point that Jake Berger is probably major league ready. Does that all kind of sound right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? I mean, if they don't trade him this winter.
So, yeah, they could do that, you know. Like, so, like, having, like, Jake Berger and Gavin Sheets, like, competing for the long-term first base job is not – that's fine.
Unless Aloy moves you, there.
You have, like – yeah. You also have still have, like, Casey Gillespie and stuff there, too.
Yeah, well, he's there, too. You know, Blake Rutherford's, I think, becoming kind of controversial in that he didn't – I thought he looked fine. I saw him a decent amount this year. I didn't see anything that wasn't in line with previous scouting reports. But, you know, we say don't scout the stat line, but we, like, do at least pay some attention to the stat line. He really didn't hit much this year. Like, it wasn't like a Mickey Moniak disaster year where he, like, was just, like, wildly flinging at everything and, like, you know, put up, like, a 2-2-3 triple slash. But it wasn't great. Like, it wasn't what you would have expected for a – even like an advanced high school bat. And I think that reflects in what they traded for him. You know, not that, you know, Tommy Connolly's awesome and David Robertson's awesome and Todd Frazier's a useful regular. And the first two of those guys were controlled for a while. But like, you know, they got Blake Rutherford as like the head of a package and like didn't like give up like a long-term regular. That's pretty good. I actually really like that trade for both sides.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, you know, I guess there's still – is it fair to say that Rutherford could there's still a non-zero chance he could hang in center for a little bit and then
– I'm not really in on him as a center fielder.
Okay. And you're looking at more some amalgam of does a little bit of everything to get you to solid – corner, you know, like
he's probably headed towards like a bunch of 50-55 tools, solid outfield regular. There was thought coming into the draft that the hit and the power would play up more. I didn't really see that, but you know, trying to evaluate guys' hit tools in low A when it's like not super obvious one way or the other is not the most fun thing in baseball to do. You know, he's got a real nice swing. He's a big physical guy. He's got some athleticism. I don't think he's center field. I mean, I just think he's too big to play center field, honestly.
Sure. I mean, like, given all those things, you know, this was something that happened, a narrative that took hold after the Giolito trade, and it sort of happened after the Rutherford trade to a lesser extent, where there's this narrative that's like, ah, you know, the White Sox didn't realize that Giolito wasn't throwing 100 anymore, or, you know.
Yeah, they did. That's why they were able to get him in the
right, trade. Right, exactly. And, I mean, to the extent that Rutherford is looking more like a league, you know, sort of a, you know, solid corner outfielder, I still think the trade makes sense with that information, as opposed to maybe at draft time the hopes for a little more.
Absolutely. You're not going to be able to get him for a trade headed by Tommy Canely if he's, you know, OFP 70 top 20 prospect in baseball. Nobody's giving that up for, I like Tommy Canely, you know, but he had had at the time of the trade like three consecutive months where he was able to throw strikes his entire career.
Yeah, and I think we can get to this when we get to the 10 to 20 guys, and I know we're probably already running later than we meant to, but
I'm used to 3-hour podcasts. So.
I would love to go 3 hours if I didn't have to head to work right after this.
Sure.
I mean, so Berger, almost certainly a first baseman, but you think he'll hit enough where that's still worthwhile.
Oh yeah, he's got like real good bat speed. He was putting on like some real good power shows like before the game. Yeah, he's pretty cool. He's as cool as he can be as a right college, probably first baseman with a bad body. Like, because that's like a really horrible profile. Michael Balbin has written about this at great length. How like college first base is just like where prospects go to die.
So I guess technically he was a college third base, but
yeah, I mean, this is a tough profile, and the fact that he's still like 11th overall, something like that, with that profile tells you how much the White Sox love that bat too.
Yeah,
he went 11th because the Rockies signed Ian Desmond, and the White Sox moved from 12 to 11.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for him to get drafted there with that profile really tells you how much the White Sox like that bat.
For sure, although their track record with drafting position player bats is sketchy enough that it lends you some pause where you're not necessarily confident. It's more,
let's talk about Zach Collins.
That's exactly where I was transitioning with that. You know, he's probably been, at least among White Sox Twitter, the most contentious prospect out there. With the Hitchiness swing, is he going to be a catcher or not? I guess after another year of seeing Zach Collins, where do you stand on him?
I mean, so I don't cover the Southern League, and I only cover the Carolina League a little bit. So I actually didn't see Zach Collins this year, so I will have to express the thoughts of our prospect team as a whole. To us, Zach Collins was like the easiest guy on this entire list to like place because like we like know what the profile is. It looks like he's probably going to catch. Trying to figure out the hit tools of guys in the low minors is hard. It's much easier than trying to figure out the receiving skills of catchers in the low minors. Because, like, sometimes it's really obvious. Like, Austin Hedges was really obvious. And Jesus Montero was really obvious the other way. But, like, there's a large space between Austin Hedges and Jesus Montero. It's, like, 60 runs in the major leagues of defensive ability. And I think Zach Collins is going to be fine there. I wouldn't bet my life on it. You know, he's like a old school, like, slugger league slugging catcher, which, you know, as long as he can catch, that's fine. And if he can't catch, that's probably not fine.
Like, is Napoli, like, a weird vision for this?
I think he's going to be better defensively than Napoli and probably not as good offensively.
Okay.
Maybe like a Molina brother with worse defense, like not like Yachty, like a Benji Molina,
yeah.
Like that kind, like the Rod Barajas offensive composition.
My thought when you told me that he's probably going to catch was to express pessimism, because normally if you have someone who you think is going to be able to catch at the major league level and has a really good hit tool or plus power, I would expect him to rank higher than 9th. On the White Sox top 10 and maybe being a borderline 101 guy.
He's hitting like two. Well, he is a borderline 101 guy. Yeah. He made it last year. He's in the mix this year.
Yeah.
But he also hit 220 as a polished college bat in high A. Which
yeah,
is
I was
like
very concerned.
Bad. Like, that's like really bad.
Yeah.
Can I invoke catchers are weird?
Yes, absolutely. But that also makes him, like, in some ways, like, he ranked 89th on our 101 last year, and I expect him to essentially rank the, like, his stock is, like, exactly even from where it was a year ago, I think, pretty much.
But with, like, defense up and bat down?
Yeah, probably. Probably bigger chance that he remains a catcher, but less positive outcome if he doesn't.
Fair. Yeah, that makes sense, based on what little I've heard, but interesting. Okay, yeah, I mean,
not really what you want to get at 10th overall either, although there's still a long time for that to play out. You know, when you're drafting in the top 10, you'd like to get, I think, greater certainty, especially when you take a college bat.
I mean, and this kind of goes back to, like, that weird, like, in retrospect, if I just flipped Hanson and Collins, let's say the White Sox took Hanson at 10 and Collins at like 50. Does that like hold up?
I don't know. Like, I guess at the time of the draft, the guy you would have wanted to take instead of Collins is Kyle Lewis, and Kyle Lewis like may never play baseball again at this point. Like, his knee is so screwed up. Oh, so, wow. I mean, I that's an exaggeration. I'm sure he'll play baseball again. It's yet to be determined whether he'll effectively play baseball again. Like, you know.
He was in play at number one, and then I remember when he was still there at 10 being like, oh, you know, here's an opportunity, but then his knee exploded, if I'm not mistaken.
They could have taken Jay Grom. Jay Grom was horrible this year, and
they could have taken Blake Rutherford.
they almost did take Blake Rutherford. but like if you look at like the guys that were drafted in like 11 to 20 in that round, like everybody's stock is down except for Forrest Whitley, who's now one of the best prospects in baseball.
I actually work with Forrest Whitley's sister.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
holding out on us, Colin.
he won't rank very highly on our global list. Yeah.
I guess. All right, so we're already way over. In terms of the next 10, which is a new feature of this year, in alphabetical order, which I really like, where especially out of the top 10, it's like the idea of making ordinal rankings on these guys is often probably impossible, but. You've got is there anybody here that jumps out at you? I know you mentioned Clarkin earlier was a guy that I remember Yankee fans being really excited about years ago, and that was like three arm injuries ago. So
yeah, I think the stuff is still there. You just can't really stay healthy, so who the hell knows?
Word is the White Sox are teaching him a cutter. I don't know how you feel about that.
If they're teaching a lefty a cutter, it's like immediately like a 2-grade jump. So.
I guess Sheets is sort of a known commodity. Jeff Paternostro made a comment in a chat that made me think he was a little higher on Puckett than I was, which encouraged me. I don't know if that's a feeling you share.
He's like that guy that has a lot of these problems, but instead of at 97 to 99 is having them at like 90 to 92, but it's still pretty good stuff. He's like in that large group of like interesting pitching prospects, of which most of them turn into relievers and a few of them turn into starters, and trying to figure out which ones it's like collect them all, which the White Sox have done, to their credit. They got him from Melky Cabrera, so, it's a nice pickup. It's good system depth. I'm not sure he's really, like, a top guy. I would probably rank him towards the back of this grouping, but he's pretty cool.
In terms of, who would you push towards the top of this group?
Probably Bisabe. Spencer Adams would be probably towards the top of this group. Zach Birdie, if he was healthy, probably would have made the top 10. He's obviously not. Sheets, probably. I really like Jason Irizarry, but I can't at this point plausibly call him like the 12th best prospect in the system.
That's still mind-blowing that he would even be in that conversation, considering they got him for bonus pool money, right?
Yeah, but look at what the Rangers are trying to do with that bonus pool money. It became very expensive for the Rangers to trade for bonus pool money at a certain point because of Ohtani.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But, I mean, even so, like, what the White Sox gave up to get him, I mean, that seems like a pretty good return.
Oh, yeah. If you're not, and they can't spend that bonus pool money because of the Robert signing. So, you're going to auction it off and... I guess the two teams have basically auctioned off their bonus pool money were the Orioles and the White Sox. The White Sox because they couldn't spend it, and the Orioles because they chose not to. And I think the White Sox generally got better returns than the Orioles did, although the Orioles got some interesting guys back, too.
Did they get Gabby and Noah for IFA money, or am I...
No, they got Gabby and Noah for actual money because the Mets. They got him for legal U.S. tender. And, I play in, one of these, crazy dynasty leagues where we, actually have international signing pools and stuff like that. And, the general conversion, the Brett Sayre general conversion rate from IFA money to real money is 2.5 multiplier. So, what, they're getting Irizarry for, a million international slot? So, that's like signing somebody to a 2.5 signing bonus type deal, which is about what Irizarry actually got back in the day.
What's like?
Yeah, he like swings like at like fucking everything, and there's a pretty good chance. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this podcast. I am on ours, and it's a local. So
you are.
We're fine.
I don't. I probably should, but.
You know, there's like a pretty good chance at this point. I think he's going to end up on the mound, but you know, it's a lot of really cool tools, and he has no idea what he's swinging at yet. But like, if he like could just figure out what he's swinging at. So picking him up as a change of scenery guy for a bunch of international money you couldn't use anyway is a pretty nifty pickup. But like realistically, he's probably like 19 or 20 out of this grouping. But at the same time, didn't they get Casey Gillespie off of waivers?
They got him for Dan Jennings.
Yeah, basically waivers. you know, they didn't get Casey Gillespie for a lot more than Irizarry is kind of the.
My hot take was I was surprised to see Jake Peter here over Bernardo Flores, but that's like, you know, so
that's going so deep
that, for Jordan.
I like Bernardo Flores. Sure, yeah.
it's almost just to be like, hey, I also know this guy's name, just for the record. But so Irizarry, I mean, like, what's the gosh, I don't know, 90 to 95th percent? You know, everything works out perfectly. He's like.
He's like
Tim Anderson.
No, he's better than Tim Anderson. 95th percentile yeast in Irizarry Cup. Jeez.
this is a great question.
I like don't even know if I can functionally answer this. Brandon Crawford, maybe? I don't know.
There you go.
Zach Cozart's good year.
Oh, snap. Okay. It's cool that that's in there
like,
at all.
So in 95th percentile, he's remaining at shortstop, which he's got a really awesome arm. He's got huge bat speed. He's got a cool swing. He's got some raw power. So 95th percentile outcomes, like all of that works out, and he figures out what he's swinging at. So you're looking at like a four tool shortstop with like a bunch of like six tools. Yeah, like Zach Cozart's really good there.
Oh, wow. All right, and I'd also maybe sort of think of how Lurie Garcia looked this year, but
that's almost certainly not going to happen. This is not outcome for.
Nah, you guys, I heard it.
I'm not advocating for you to trade for Jason Irizarry in your fantasy.
you're on the record here. Jared Seiler thinks Jason Irizarry is going to be a down ballot MVP candidate. Colin, do you have anything on these next 10 guys before you get to the 25 and under?
I don't think so. Yeah, like you said, we are kind of running short on time, or I should say I'm running short on time. I guess I could leave and just let you guys keep talking. but I do have to upload the post, so I guess that wouldn't work. No, I don't think, you know, like kind of like you said, everyone else in this kind of next 10 is just kind of big question mark. Basabe, I was happy to see you had Basabe probably as the top of that group because I know that he wasn't really hitting last year, but he still has a lot of tools that people are excited about.
It's important to note that this is the good Basabe, and they did not, like the Diamondbacks, screw up which one was which.
Yes.
This is the top prospect.
Do you think that's true? Do you think that really happened?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Man.
I've heard it from too many people, and I had heard it before it became public too. So.
Also, you mentioned Spencer Adams. I know people seem to be a little bit down on him. You know, he's not really striking anyone out in the minors. Is there still reason for optimism with him?
Yeah, I mean the stuff's still there. He's still, you know, he hasn't been bad. I guess the stock's a little bit down, but I think he's more, and I think this is probably also the case with Fulmer, they've gotten pushed down the system more by acquisitions than,
yeah,
like, falling off the prospect radar, so to speak. Like, he's still, like, your pretty typical, like, 100th to 150th best prospect in baseball, like, just kind of starting pitcher, puttering along, you know, decent chance at a mid-rotation type outcome.
Adams has always been... It's interesting to me because I feel like he's just sort of held steady at the same profile where it's like, dude doesn't walk anybody. He's got a really nice build. He's super athletic, but he just doesn't miss as many bats as you'd think.
Yeah, I mean, he's not, you know, he's been pretty consistent around, like, you know, 6 to 7 strikeouts per nine. It's not like he's, like, terrible. And he's been young for the leagues he's pitched in. He's, you know, still got pretty decent stuff. I don't see any reason to be down on him, per se. I think people were waiting for a breakout there, and he's never really broken out.
He's always someone that I've followed, and maybe other people have that pay attention to the White Sox closely, just because he was the rare, and, you know, they've been a little bit better about it lately, but the White Sox have always been, you know, relatively adverse of, you know, going over slot on their draft picks. And, you know, they took him, they took Adams, I think, in the second round as an overslot high schooler. And so when they do that, it kind of opens my eyes a little bit, like, oh, you know, maybe there's something here. And so I've been following him a little bit more closely because of that.
Do I get to ask you guys questions about the 25 and under, since you're responsible for that?
Well, Nick, for the record, it's just Nick that's responsible for it. I just argue with him about it a lot.
It's true.
Kopech over Rodon is, like, really aggressive to me.
Interesting. The question?
Why is Rodon bull Kopech?
So I talked – this was so just generally speaking, you know, obviously I'm deferring to the prospect team in terms of how you sequence the prospect. Did you – all right, so before I answer that, did you have any dispute with Eloy over Rodon?
A little bit, but it's harder to measure because you're like – it's like the –
same position.
Yeah, it's like different positions. It's different points. It's much different points on the developmental scale.
No issue with Moncada one?
Not really. I mean, I know there are people like in the White Sox and even the prospect adjacent community that are like really worried about his strikeout rate. Like, so if he continues to strike out a ton, he's going to be what, like Jason Kipnis kind of player?
Yeah.
That's still like a really good baseball player.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like if he hits 240, he's still like average to above average, given everything else he does, and then
he
everything
might
above
still put it together. Like,
yeah,
you can't call these when guys are 22, and when they're already an above average major league player at 22 too. Like, you can't expect no growth from there.
Yeah. So. Okay, so the Rodon versus Kopech was definitely like one of the harder decisions I had to make.
I hope so.
And in all right, so I talked to, I don't know if Craig knew these conversations were going to become on the record, but I definitely
talked
about it for a while. But I mean, yeah, it's like the debate between, obviously Rodon just got cut on, which is not great. He has never really had a chance to put it all together, which speaks to, in 2016, I will attribute a lot of that to his catchers, because, like, you know, say what you want about, I know framing's not a silver bullet, but at the same time, he had, like, I think he was top 10 for pitchers injured by framing runs for a young pitcher whose biggest issue is just getting ahead in the count. That's kind of a big deal. And this year, you know, I don't know how much more cautious they were because it's rebuilding year than they would have been otherwise. That as well. But now, I mean, to me, it's like a choice between a guy who hasn't really failed yet versus a guy who's struggled a little bit. And at this point, I'm more comfortable saying Kopech's best outcome is now better than Rodon's. I don't know if that's hot takey, but I mean, it's more like, you know, we're 3 years into Rodon pitching in the majors, and he's yet to put together like a full plus season. I know there's more to it than that. And I was, you know, you could probably, depending on who I last spoke to, you could probably talk me into this either way. And kind of based on.
It looks weird because of how long we've been talking about Carlos Rodon is ace of all aces. But at the same time, we're like, you know, almost 400 innings into a major league career now, where he's yet to really be an above average starter, and he just had major shoulder surgery.
Is it safe to say that Kopech's ceiling is higher than Rodon's, but his floor is also lower than Rodon's?
I don't even know if that's true anymore because of the shoulder surgery.
That's the biggest thing. Like if Rodon had I mean, I don't know where you get to where O'Donnelly pitches 69 pretty nice innings last year without injury. Nice. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like the dude pitched 69 innings last year. Pick a reason why that is. But, like, I you know, throw in the surgery. And who knows? Maybe, you know, last year I put Tim Anderson over Yoan Moncada. That was because Tim Anderson had shown the argument being Anderson had demonstrated present ability to at least hang as a major league shortstop, which put him ahead of a guy who had yet to see AAA as a second baseman.
And then he walked 13 times in a full season.
Yeah, but like Anderson could have a good year where he does that. You know, like the problem with Anderson this year was that his defense cratered.
I mean, look like what Jonathan Scope did this year.
Sure, like, you know, I don't feel like that's going to look great long term, but I could still tell you why, and I feel good about it. This is kind of the inverse of that argument of, like, a guy who's shown he can at least get major league hitters out versus the guy who hasn't really had a shot yet. But the shoulder surgery just scares the hell out of me, so that's my, like, fallback answer to that.
I have to quickly check if a list is going up before this one. Hold on a second.
I should also mention while Jarrett's talking that we're talking about Kopech over Rodon or these certain orders, and like Jarrett mentioned earlier, we're recording on a Sunday and this is going up on Friday, so we may change our minds and they may change our minds. Everyone might change their minds by the time this recording is listened to.
The list that's going up before your list is the Phillies list, and I had the Phillies 25 and under, and I had a lot of the same issue with, like, Rhys Hoskins versus J.P. Crawford.
Mm.
Granting that J.P. Crawford had a month in the majors, but, like, and at the end, and also Aaron Nola versus both of them. I ended up going Nola, Hoskins, Crawford.
Yeah.
And that's partially because I think Nola's got a lot of indicators that he's already an ace, but just, like, not getting ace outcomes, partially because his team around him sucks.
And he's had some injuries.
He's had some injuries, minor, not as concerning as Rodon, and he's pitched better than Rodon.
That's also interesting because the White Sox were supposedly picking between Rodon and Nola in that draft.
That was one of the reasons I brought him up.
Ah.
But, you know, like, Hoskins did not make our midseason 50. He was one of the last cuts from the midseason 50. And so I'm jumping him over a lot of Phillies prospects. But I'm also pretty goddamn sure, like, Rhys Hoskins might not be Mark McGwire, which if you take, like, his 2017 major league performance at face value, he is, but I'm pretty certain he's like a 250, 40 home run bat based on what we've seen. And that is just better than all of those guys. So it's like, I don't know. The 25 and under lists are always weird because you have to evaluate like fairly complete major league information a lot of the time versus incomplete minor league information. But then sometimes it can be the opposite too. Like Rodon's an example of a guy that, how much stock do you still put in the fact that we all thought he was going to be an ace in 2014?
Well, yeah. I mean, so last year when I did the 25 and under, I had two guys in the major league level who were worth considering in Rodon and Anderson. And I basically put them at the top.
Sure.
And Moncada was the only guy really challenging that. And I agonized over Anderson versus Moncada and went Anderson. And who knows, you know, that still may not look too bad.
I'm left on that one.
Yeah, and like I said, based on what I knew at the time, you know, demonstrable major league skill versus, you know, question mark. But like this was so much harder in that, you know, I've got four guys from the major league roster on this list. No, five guys. And like, for example, one of the things I was considering at the back end was weighing, the last guy in was Robert versus Delmonico. Even though I know Delmonico is like, whatever, probably. But like the idea that you have someone who might never make the majors versus someone who's looking like at least a role player on a major league team, like what do I do with that? You know?
I remember last year I had like the weirdest one of these ever, which on the Mets list was Wilmer Flores versus Thomas Zupacki. Like, Wilmer Flores is a 25-year-old established major league, like, good fifth infielder, marginal regular. And Thomas Zupacki is, like, a flame-throwing guy in short season ball.
Right.
You can't get further apart on these.
Yeah, I mean, at least Robert and Delmonico are both outfielders. But, like, Delmonico himself, even for a guy in the majors, has a really weird track record and has succeeded in ways that are really weird. You know, like, normally a guy who's got a small sample that looks really nice, but that's probably better than he can really sustain, doesn't have, like, a really nice strikeout-to-walk ratio. Usually those guys have, like, a really nice batting average for a few weeks. So, like, there were a lot of really weird decisions to make on the 25 and under. Rodon versus Kopech, even though it's the same position. I mean, right now, in a way, if you zoom out far enough and kind of cheat, the things in their favor are great velocity and great breaking pitch. You know, and then the rest is kind of like TBD, even though Rodon's been in the majors for 3 years. So I kind of let the shoulder surgery be the tiebreaker, if that makes sense, even though that they're apart. Anderson versus Giolito and Lopez was also weird. I put Giolito and Lopez ahead of Hanson and Cease just because they've shown they can at least get guys out in the majors. To what degree and in what shape they'll do that long term remains to be seen. But, like, I don't know, that felt a little easier, especially that Giolito and Lopez were still ahead of Hanson on the midseason 50. But
So. And those are still guys with those are still basically prospects. Like, they're not that far away from Hanson on the developmental cycle. Like, we still have a pretty broad. They're ineligible for our prospect list, but there are a lot of guys like them on the prospect list, I guess is what I'm trying
to say. I think that's what the 25 and under is trying to capture, right? Like,
yeah, but it just misses, like, you know, like, I think Noah Syndergaard still on the Mets 25 and under. Like, yeah, it's like, unfortunately, we can't rank 25 and under except for, like, stars and established dudes. Like, we can't just rank 25 and under guys that have large deltas. I mean, I guess we could, but nobody would read it.
I think it helps for, like, the Twins, where they've, like, graduated all their dudes, or a lot of their guys, where it's like, all right, Buxton, Sano, and...
I mean, realistically, it's... all prospect content at some level is fantasy content, and especially when we're doing lists. Yeah. Like, people just want to see, this guy ranks over this guy. Okay, this helps me in my fantasy league decide, like, whether I should trade this guy for this guy.
Yeah, it's a fun exercise, even though I don't know, you know, is Rodon versus Kopech the biggest sticking point for you there?
It wasn't a sticking point, it just looked weird. I think you have it for the right reasons.
Sure.
I don't. Yeah, biggest, I don't.
What's the word? Like, maybe, room for argument, I guess?
I guess you could argue Tim Anderson a little lower, just based on. I don't know what the hell Tim Anderson is. I'm not sure I've ever known what the hell Tim Anderson was.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the fact is, like, he's still so high risk. I think James was saying, like, with Anderson, you get hit from both sides on, like the Saber guys who just want to be like, oh, well, he doesn't walk, so he's terrible. And then there's also still, like, I don't know, there's like, he didn't hit for high average this year. It was just getting into the intangible stuff where it's like his best friend got murdered and, like, what do you do with that? But, like,
that's a little harsher than I was expecting.
Oh, well,
I feel like I knew that at some point, but I had forgotten about it.
Yeah, no, right before the season started, his best friend got killed in a drive-by.
It wasn't even before. It was like early May is when it happened. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he, you know, like, so you got to the players weekend jerseys and Anderson's was B Moss. And I was like, what is
that? Right, I remember that. Yeah.
And then, so sorry, I don't mean to end on, like, a negative note, but, but, like, that just goes to the further, like, you know, Anderson's basically wearing an old timey Riddler suit where he's just covered in question marks for me. Like, I don't know what the hell, but, like, I don't want to just discard the possibility that he's, like, possibly a present, like, league average to maybe a little better shortstop. Like, that's there, I think. It's in there, but who knows? Jared, thank you so much for joining us for so much of this, and especially because I know you're crazy busy with all these other lists, and George St. Pierre's doing stuff and wrestling stuff.
Oh, hang on. I want to know Jarrett's thoughts on Omega Jericho.
I knew that was the one wrestling question. All right, so like I'm like, how old are you, Colin?
I'm 30.
Okay, I'm 33. Chris Jericho is like the cool dude from like when we were like teenage wrestling fans, right?
Yeah.
So I like love this thing. I don't like they can run Omega and Ibushi on like any pay per view, and it's still gonna be a 5¾ star match or whatever we decided that Kenny Omega's matches are now. Like, and that could be in Osaka, or it could be, Invasion Attack, or whatever the hell
for sure. Want to do.
Or it could be G1, or whatever. But, like, this is the one chance they're going to have this match. And I know it's not Chris Jericho of 2000.
No, it's a nostalgia trip to a certain extent, for sure.
But for one match, he's going to go, and Omega's going to go crazy carrying him.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a great match, and it's going to be a fun match, and it has greatly enhanced the allure of this show, I think, to people around our age that don't regularly watch New Japan.
Yeah, New Japan's really, really, really trying to jump more into the American market, too, and that's going to help with that. Right, just like the Western market in general.
My podcast co-host Jeffrey went from like, yeah, maybe I'll watch it on a tape delay on Access or whatever, to like, man, I'm going to a Wrestle Kingdom party and I'm taking the day off of work.
I'm doing exactly that. And the other thing about that match is that, even if Jericho Omega isn't like, at least they're not building the card around it. I mean, even if that match ends up being a dud, which it won't, you still have Naito and Okada. Which is going to be
fucking awesome. You got that crazy junior four-way match.
Yeah. It's going to be a good card, even if Omega and Jericho disappoint you somehow.
You know, Tanahashi's going to go nuts trying to make Jay White into a star in one night.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to be, it's not on paper, like, as great as, like, an in-ring as, like, especially last year was, like, where you, like, just knew, like, the last three matches are going to be, like, all flirting with five stars.
Yeah. That was my first. That was the first time, for the record, I'm still kind of a newbie with non-WWE wrestling, but that was the first New Japan show I ever watched live, was this year's, Wrestle Kingdom, and I was hooked from that point on, obviously.
And it's also worth noting, in regards to Jericho and New Japan, that Jericho's a really big star in Japan, too. Oh, yeah. Like, out of all the WWE guys, like, that they could bring in to face Omega, Jericho might mean the most out of them.
For sure. I could actually, if I had unlimited time and unlimited money, I could have a pretty crazy wrestling week, because we have, I'm going to NXT Live on Thursday. They're doing a house show in Austin. And then Friday, there's a ROH show in San Antonio, which I may or may not go to. Again, depends on time and money. And then Saturday, there's NXT in Houston, but there's also a Wrestle Circus show here locally where the main event is, fuck, I don't remember. Like,
well, isn't there also the NXT house show in San Antonio on Friday?
Yeah, there's NXT house show in San Antonio on Friday, but I'm going to the one in Austin on Thursday. So
okay,
yeah. Right. And then obviously Sunday after the two Survivor Saturday, I think Sunday is Survivor Series. So
which all of a sudden is a much greater looking card than it was a week ago.
Absolutely. So just wanted to get my couple minutes of wrestling talk in there at the end, and I think Nick might be asleep.
No, I'm here. Like, I want to participate. My wife's Japanese, so there's the Japan angle is definitely, like, feels like I'll come in at Thanksgiving to Jane's mom and act like NXT will be, like, bridging some sort of cultural gap for me.
Not
NXT is the WWE, American product.
New Japan, NJPW.
That's it. I'm still trying to go to an MPB game, like, let alone all this. So.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
So to wrap things up, to anybody who's willing to, who went through, maybe you reward the wrestling fans who didn't just hit stop at that point. anything you're particularly want to highlight coming up? I know you're just going to be churning out prospect content, and if there's anything deeper down in the White Sox system we didn't touch on that you just wanted to, like, get on the record? Any of that is more than...
Not off of the top of my head. Oh, geez, like, White Sox deep sleeper. Yeah, I would need, like, 5 minutes to prepare on that one. All right. So.
We'll Adolfo, you said, was the type of profile that pans out, like, 5% of the
time. Yeah, Mike Rodolfo is certainly a... I like Mike Rodolfo more than most of the BP team, which is less than the rest of the world, I guess. He's interesting, but it's like, I don't know. They had a couple of interesting outfielders in low A that got bumped up when they acquired everybody. Luis Gonzalez was one of the end of the season guys. Joel Booker was kind of a little bit interesting. He's like a guy that might be like a major league fourth outfielder. Luis Gonzalez, son of Luis Gonzalez, is kind of interesting. It's not the deepest system once you get past like the top 15 type kind of guys. You know, you still got like your Trey Mikolshevskis kicking around and...
It's kind of fun to be here because last year we at this time it was post sale and Eaton trades, but we were talking to Jeff and it was like, yeah, we wrote up a top 10, but for the White Sox, there's like 10 dudes and that's it.
It's like 11, like 11 like was like eight. Trey Mikolshevskis.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's like there's like 18 dudes and Trey Mikolshevskis is like 25. Yeah. So yeah.
And they've already graduated like four. So
like Tyquan Forbes was somebody that almost made the top 20. I don't,
really?
He's really athletic. I don't think he can hit. He had some supporters for the list. I was not one of them.
Flores is my deep cut guy, but
he's I saw him earlier.
I like him. I also like Ian Hamilton. That's my guy.
Okay.
Oh, I forgot about Hamilton.
He's just a potential late inning reliever at ceiling kind of guy, probably. College closer. They drafted in like the 10th round. Anyway.
Fair enough. But Jared, thank you so much. Like I said, I know you're swamped, so I really appreciate it. And I know prospect stuff is like the red meat for White Sox fans right now. So really appreciate it.
Yeah. And oh, I will, for those of you listening, you can follow Jared at JA Seidler. I'll link to the top 10 White Sox prospect list within this podcast post. Be sure to check that out. Friday morning, White Sox Top 10. This podcast, follow Jarrett's work on Baseball Prospectus and our work on BP Southside. So thanks again, Jarrett, and thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk to you later.